WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jim Gallopo, knows a lot about gangs. He's worked with LA gang members for close to 28 years, ever since the aftermath of the Watts riots. Gallopo is a probation officer with the Los Angeles County Metropolitan Specialized Gang Unit. This year, he's worked to help keep a truce that was declared between gangs in Watts and Compton just before riots erupted in L.A. after the first Rodney King beating trial. He says the truce has held in Watts and is shakier in Compton. There's a modified truce in other neighborhoods. This has made Gallopo's job somewhat easier. Now there's communication between the gangs. And even if they're not hanging out together, they're at least less likely to kill each other. I asked Gallopo to describe what his job entails.
Well, basically what we do is enforce conditions of probation imposed by the court. And they're specialized conditions that relate to gang members. We're not to associate with known gang members, not to... they give up their search and seizure rights as a condition of probation and, you know, things like this. But basically, beyond that, what I try to do as an individual gang officer is I try to use the OGs or the original gangster, older guys who the younger guys look up to and, you know, hold in reverence. I've been doing it so long, I know the older guys. And a lot of times they mature after they've been in a prison or they've been into enough stuff. They want to help see to it that the younger guys don't get off into it. And they will work with me to help the younger guys, you know, to settle disputes rather than, you know, engaging in drive-bys and, you know, and weapon violence.
Now, how do you monitor people who are on probation to make sure that they're not associating with gang members?
Well, that's difficult because of the fact that all my cases are hardcore gang members and they all live in gang areas. I mean, they can't actually step out of their house. In a lot of cases, their brothers and sisters are gang members. So, you know, that is an idealistic condition that is not always, you know, I mean, you don't have to deal with the letter of the law on that. What I try to see to is they don't go off into the illegal gang activities. I mean, they're going to go to school with gang members. You can't keep them from that. They're going to, you know, walk down the street where gang members are. You can't keep them from that. But you can keep them from getting in cars and going out and doing drive-bys or, you know, going out and hoorahing at parties and all this kind of stuff together. You know, that's kind of like where we differentiate.
So is it your job to stay on the streets, look around, yes, and see who's doing what?
Yeah, I basically, what I do, you know, because of prior to the truce, my gang members could not really come to my office. So I saw all of my clients on the streets. I have every gang member in my caseload is supposed to call me every Monday. Monday's my office day, and they call me between 10 in the morning and 5 at night. And then I set up home calls for the rest of the week. You know, when they call, I set up, tell them where I'm going to see them in school, whether I'm going to see them in the park, whether I'm going to see them at the home or the job or whatever. And that way I keep a better feeling for what's going on the streets by being out there. And most of my activity is at night. I prefer to go out and, you know, to be out on the streets at night.
So before the truce, gang members, the former gang members couldn't come to your office because what, your office is on gang turf?
Yeah, you know, and it wasn't as much. Well, it was. I mean, basically, they had to go through too many rival gang areas to get to my office, which is on Imperial Highway in Normandy. And my gangs basically are from Florence, you know, they're considerably north of the area where my office is.
You've been doing this job a long time. Has your job become more dangerous as more gang members have gotten guns and drugs?
No question.
What kind of dangers are you exposed to now that you weren't earlier in your career?
More sophisticated weapons. You know, the nature of the gang has changed a lot over the last 25 years or so since the gang started. And basically, in the black gangs, it used to be what we call going from the shoulders, where guys would fight basically one-on-one. There could be 50 gang members from each gang there, but the two guys would go at it, and maybe a few other side fights would break out. But, you know, it was one-on-one, basically, and when one guy beat the other guy, in essence, into submission, then, you know, that was over. And there was no disrespect, you know, to lose to a guy who was that much tougher than you. Nowadays, these guys don't do that. They don't have what we call the heart anymore they used to have. And they'll go by 40 miles an hour in a van and shoot a shotgun. You know, by the time they hit somebody, they don't even know who they hit. By the time the person hits the ground, they're three blocks down the street. So there's a lot, it's a lot less personal. There's a lot less courage. There's a lot less discipline or honor involved. And what attracted me to the gangs initially was the fact that there was a lot of honor involved. They had a code and they lived by it. Today, it's just not that way. I mean, you know, you never could used to be able to get a gang member to what you call snitch or to roll over, you know, on another gang member. Now, I mean, it's just commonplace that they will do that.
What's the age range of the people who you see? The people who are, you know,
my youngest probationer is normally around 15 years old, which I have very few of. My oldest is in their late 30s, which I have very few of. The majority of them are between 17 and 20 years old.
The ones who are 15, are they sometimes more difficult to deal with because they're young and inexperienced?
Certainly.
What makes them more difficult? In what ways are they more difficult?
They are normally involved in an activity we call making their bones, which is trying to, you know, to gain status in the gang. And so they will do any crazy thing to try to bring themselves up in the eyes of the more high-status gang members, like drive-bys or walk-in liquor store robberies and bank robberies and all kinds of things that they'll do to try to gain status in the gang. Shoot at a police car from an apartment or a house or, you know, a corner, you know, just things that would bring them status.
So they're still trying to prove themselves.
Yeah,
and that
exactly.
Makes them a little crazier.
That's exactly. There's a word for it in the Hispanic gangs called Vato Loco. And you know, it fits the black gangs, too.
How effective do you think prison is in punishing or reforming gang members?
Well, I think it's very effective in punishing, but I just see little or no evidence that there's any rehabilitation or reformation going on. I mean, you know, sometimes a guy will burn out. He'll get old enough in prison, he'll been there long enough and just say, I don't want to come back to this mess. This is a zoo, it's crazy, and you know, no matter what I got to do, I'm not coming back here. And, you know, but the prison system in California is, you know, I understand from colleagues around the country, everywhere else, is just a revolving door. And, you know, people a lot of times feel safer because a guy gets, you know, 8 years in the penitentiary for some heinous crime. And, you know, the guy's going to do three, you know, and get paroled, or four and get paroled. And he's back. And when they come back, they're worse than when they went in too many cases. You know, they're buffed up physically. They're stronger from lifting weights and eating well and going, you know, getting sleep and rest and exercise and all this. And mentally, they're just, you know, one of the guys who described it great to me, when you're in the joint, you got to act crazy, you know, to survive. And, you know, once you act crazy and learn the crazy way of life, again, there's a Hispanic slogan called La Vida Loca, and that is, you know, crazy life. And, you know, they learn to act crazy, be crazy, and they come back out. It's hard to get through with that.
My guest is Jim Gallopo, a probation officer with the Los Angeles County Metropolitan Specialized Gang Unit. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is L.A. Probation Officer Jim Gallopo. Now, you were telling us that there was more of a code when you were younger, you know, when you started working this job, and that's part of what interested you in the gangs, and
yeah.
That code doesn't really exist anymore. So what keeps you on the job?
I don't know. I'm old. You know, I've developed a relationship with gang members who are, some of them now, are almost 40 years old. who are the original Crips and Bloods, they're like a family to me. I have, I'm in a unique situation, particularly being a Caucasian, that I care about them, and they care about me, and we've had a long life together, and most of them should not have lived to be as old as they are by, statistical inference. And their retort to me is, you certainly shouldn't have lived to be as old as you are, being down here as long as you've been. And, it's true.
You're saying you're close with a lot of the original gang members.
OGs.
Yeah. Now, so is there often a turning point in a relationship that you have with a gang member where you go from being the authority figure that they do not want to deal with to someone who they trust and feel more close to?
Yeah. Every gang member that makes it with me reaches that point.
What do you mean by making it? Like they make it through probation?
They either make it to that point, or they're dead, or they're incarcerated for long periods of time. And, when they come out, even some of them have come back and said, man, I wish I had listened then, I'd like to work with you. I'd like to try to help you, because they're these youngsters, no matter how much they respect me as a probation officer, I'm still the man, and these guys are the guys that they look to like the second coming of Christ. These are the guys they listen to. These are the guys they admire. These are the guys they want to be like. And when these guys can turn around and come back and say, let me tell you what it was like being in San Quentin or in Folsom, or here's what it was like when I got sentenced to the joint, and my wife came up with my kids and was saying goodbye to me at county jail before I went to the joint, and I saw, a guard or somebody pinch her on the ass or disrespect her, and I'm sitting behind, a cage and all this type of thing. And then, they go into the homosexual pressure and the gang pressure and, the physical violence in the penitentiary. And, these guys, nobody can do it like these guys can, And they tell them, you don't want to do this. You do not want to have to live the life I did. And let me show you how you can still have heart and not do that.
Now, you were in gangs when you were young, right?
Well, they weren't the same kind of gangs. When I was young, they were basically car clubs that acted like the early Crips and the black gangs prior to the Crips and Bloods. I was involved, but I was not like the only real gangs when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s were the Hispanic gangs. And basically, they were out of East Los Angeles, and they were already in their second or third generation by the time I was growing up, and those were the real gang members.
Were you ever in prison?
No.
Juvenile hall?
No.
Okay.
Jail, yes.
You were in jail, okay.
Yeah, I was in jail a number of times, but I never quite made it. I had an existential experience with a police officer and a probation officer that ultimately changed my life around when I was young.
With a probation officer?
Yeah, a probation officer and a juvenile police officer in Long Beach.
What happened, and did that affect you becoming a probation officer yourself? Maybe.
I guess it did.
What happened?
Not consciously. Uh-huh. Well, I was a real delinquent when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I was into stealing cars and fighting and breaking into liquor store warehouses and did commercial burglaries on music stores and. I was just a fast kid. My mother had multiple sclerosis and was dying since my birth. And my father was a milling machinist first at the Naval Shipyard in Long Beach and ultimately at Douglas Aircraft. And he worked a swing shift so he could, take care of my mother. And when he'd even try to save his car by walking about 2 miles to a bus stop, taking a bus to Douglas, get there at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, come back, get back around 1 o'clock in the morning. They'd have to change my mother's total bed and wash her body and everything because she had defecated and urinated all over herself. And he'd get about 3 hours sleep, and then he'd have to get up, and he would get up and wake me up and cook me breakfast so he could be with me. That's the only time we got to see each other. So I basically was on my own to do what I wanted to do all the time. And, you know, I just got in with a fast crowd and got into drugs and violence and, you know, all this kind of thing. And he'd go out and go to work, and I'd sneak out of his car. You know, go pick up my homeboys, pick up girls, go do all this kind of stuff, drinking, using marijuana, you know, all this stuff when I was real young. And I got arrested a lot. So ultimately, one time I came to jail as usual, and you know, they called my father at Douglas, and he'd have to, you know, after he got off work, he'd have to take a bus home, get in his car, and come down and get me out, which would usually be, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning or so. And, you know, the cops were, and the probation officer was there at the time, when, you know, they were talking, you know, telling me what a punk I was and a little asshole and all that, and I'm telling them, you, and you know, we're gonna send you up, and I'm saying get down and do what I ain't afraid of your jail. You know, I kind of look forward to going to camp, because, you know, then I there was a badge of honor, and I thought it might be a nice experience, you know, and I wasn't afraid physically, and you know, so I was in a repartee with the police and the probation officer, and they were angry, and I knew they were gonna send me up, and you know, I basically always been willing to you know, to be responsible for my own behavior that way. You know, I figure where I go, I'm, you know, I do what I'm ready to do the time. So here comes my father, and I'm like 6'1", I weigh about 230 pounds. In those days, I was, you know, a fairly good-sized kid, too. But, you know, my dad was like 5'3", you know, and my mother was like 5 feet. And they told him, you know, I would be a sickly, you know, child and all that. She could have had me aborted in 1942 when I was born. And, I mean, look how I turned out. Tells you the extent of medical science. But at any rate, so, you know, this man who never smoked, never drank, never womanized, all his whole social life was taking care of me and my mother. And they would go for rides when he didn't work. You know, they'd go for rides in the car, and that was his whole total existence. I was smart enough to realize at that time that I couldn't take care of my mother and without him. And the only prayer, I was raised Catholic, and the only prayer I ever said was, please, God, don't let this man die, you know, until I'm old enough that I could take care of my mother. And so here he came, you know, and I'd never seen the man cry. You know, he was quiet, gentle. You know, he was a man of extreme, you know, honor, but he just, we were from New Hampshire, and we'd come out here when I was 10 years old, and we're French Canadians, they call us Canucks, and, you know, and he never knew anything about the kind of life that there would be when he came to Long Beach. He came because my mother was, you know, unable to tolerate the winters in New Hampshire, so he just asked him at the Navy Yard, hey, is there a warmer climate that's got a Navy Yard that would want a milling machinist? And they gave him a 2-week, you know, with pay, and, you know, to go out to Long Beach, and, you know, he put everything we owned on a 40 Plymouth, like the Grapes of Wrath, built a box on top of it, and here we came, you know, across the country to Long Beach. And
how does the cop and the probation officer come into it?
Well, okay, here it is. So anyway, I'm just trying to give you a background on my father. So anyway, he came in, and I, you know, at the time, it was an existential moment. Because I was, you know, cussing out the cops, and they were in the probation officer cussing me out. Here comes my father, and they tell him, Mr. Gallipo, you know, we're going to have to take your son away from you. You know, he's just, you can't control him. I know you've tried everything. We know your wife is sick, but we're going to have to put him someplace where, you know, because he's just too wild and all this. And all, you know, and I looked around at my father and winked and said, hey, them, you know, excuse me, you know, they ain't nothing. They can't hurt me. They put me in their camp. I'll be back out, no problem. And I looked at him, and he started crying. He just broke down physically and started sobbing. And I'd never seen this man. This man had been, without me knowing it, the strongest man I'd ever known, and to this date, he probably is. And I just, you know, I looked at him and realized I had done this to him. And he just broke down and started sobbing, telling him, look, I'll get another job too. You know, I'll put him in a private school. I'll work all day and night to pay for it. Don't take him away. It'll kill his mother. It will kill his mother to put him, you know, away. Please don't do that. I'll do anything. I'll do anything. And all of a sudden I realized the prayer I'm praying to God, you know, I am executing. You know, I am killing this man. I am killing this man. You know, and he's doing this kind of thing for me and my mother, and I'm out there killing him. So I turned around to them and said, hey, give me a chance, you know, and you ain't nothing and you ain't shit and you don't deserve to have a father like that. And I said, look, just give me one chance. Give me one chance. I'm not afraid to go to your jail. You know that. But please, I can't do this to them. I said, you give me a chance. And they did. They gave me 6 months to, you know, to straighten out my act. And you know, I went to my little gang meeting and told everybody, you know, that I was out, you know, that I loved them and that I loved the streets and the stuff we were doing. But that I just had to, you know, I explained the situation exactly as it occurred. And, I mean, some of those guys cried, you know. And one guy came out with me. When I walked out of the meeting, he came out and said, hey, you know, my mother's a nurse, man. She's taking care of me and my sister alone. And I'm doing the same thing to her. He said, let's go get girlfriends. So, you know, I said, let's go down to the rich area and get girlfriends. And the next Saturday we went down there and got girlfriends right away because we were like considered what they call hoods, and all the rich girls down at the beach, you know, were intrigued by us, and the surfer boys were afraid of us, you know, and all that. We just went down there and got girlfriends, and I didn't get arrested again until I was 18 years old.
Well, but you got arrested again when you were 18.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, I got good grades in school, and, right, you know, it was college material and all that. But that all happened at that moment because of my father, you know, and that changed my life.
Jim, one last question. Do you ever tell the story to the gang members that you're working with?
It's hard for me, but I do. I do it, you know, when I have a case that I think really needs, you know, something, because it's still emotional. My father's been dead now for four or five years, but, you know, it's just, it is something very emotional for me to say, you know, to discuss this. And I do it, you know, it's painful for me to think back to what I had done, you know, to this man for so many years and all that. And, you know, so I don't do it frequently, but I do it when I think it's necessary, and it's usually very impressive.
Jim Gallipo, thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay.
Jim Gallipo is a probation officer with the L.A. County Metropolitan Specialized Gang Unit. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.